Hello, welcome to Muriel's Murders. I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. This week, we are taking a request.
Nice.
From Hallie G.
Oh, hell yeah.
Randall Woodfield, the I-5 killer.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we're talking about today. Randy was a brutal serial killer who roamed Washington, Oregon, and California, driving up and down the I-5 corridor.
The I-5 corridor?
The I-5 corridor.
Nice.
A drive we've taken many times.
Yep.
Hold on to your butts.
No. Don't say it. Why? Why, Muriel?
Can I share something personal right now?
Of course.
Procrastinated on this one for a while, thinking that I had a perfect idea. Yeah. Turns out it was a lot more work than I did. We normally record this around between like 8 and 10 in the morning. It is now 3 o'clock.
In the afternoon.
In the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
Nick has to edit this, and it's about twice as long as I thought it was going
to
be.
So hold on to your butts.
All right, let's go. Let's go.
All right. We do want to thank Kristen, Tim, Annie, and Rosie for signing up for our Patreon. We appreciate you all so much. We also want to thank Ariel Nissenblatt, Earbuds Podcast Collective, Sounds Profitable, and The Succotash Show for telling people to listen to Muriel's Murders. Every time one of you guys recommends this podcast to someone in your life, it really makes a difference. Thank you so much.
All right. Remember, this is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and you don't want to hear about those kind of things, please consider just listening to a different podcast.
And if any of you are grumpy like Muriel and don't like people who joke or curse, turn us off.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay, let's get started.
Well, we really haven't done a lot of serial killers on this show. Not really.
No, especially like this style of serial killer.
Oh, so God, like gruesome, like stab people and stuff kind of serial killer.
You'll find out. It's going to be a story. Okay. The source that we used for this episode primarily is the book The I-5 Killer by the famous author Anne Rule. This is my first time reading one of her books. It was very entertaining.
Well, I've never even heard of her.
Excellent. So. That does not surprise me. I also read a few articles I'll be referencing, but most of this is from Anne Rule's book.
Beautiful.
Okay, here we go.
You got this, Muriel. I'm rooting for you.
I-5 is an interstate freeway that runs from the furthest northwestern U.S. state of Washington through Oregon, all the way down the center of California.
Mm-hmm.
In 1980, the term serial killer or spree killer was relatively new. DNA testing, as we know it, wouldn't be developed until 1986. The internet wouldn't be made public for another 3 years, and police departments were still communicating with each other through methods developed in the 1960s.
Mm. So it's like pigeons and stuff.
Well, it was like around, but I mean, if you can imagine,
they're just like calling him on the phone.
Yeah,
like
there's going no to voicemail. Internet. There's a database, but it wasn't really the way it is now. You know, it was easy for similar crimes to happen, you know, without actual different jurisdictions communicating with each other.
Right.
And on top of that, serial killers were just a new thing.
Uh-huh.
People were kind of being like, whoa, hey, you know, I think Ted Bundy is doing stuff in the 70s. But I mean, it was relatively new, like within the decade of people really understanding what that was about.
Okay.
In 1980, a series of robberies and violent sex crimes targeting women in the northwestern part of the country along the I-5 corridor began.
Mm-hmm.
On December 9th, 1980, a man wearing a ridiculous fake beard and tape on his nose robbed an Arco at gunpoint in Vancouver, Washington. December 13th in Eugene, Oregon, a man robbed a Baskin and Robbins in the same dumb beard and nose tape. December 14th, he robbed a drive-through Arctic Circle in Albany, Oregon.
What the hell is an Arctic Circle?
Like a gas station.
Okay.
And on December 21st, he went into a Church's Chicken in Seattle, Washington, wearing the same stupid beard. He ordered a fried chicken meal, paid for it, ate it, then forced his way into the women's bathroom and held a female employee by gunpoint. He sexually assaulted her, then told her to sit down on the floor and count to 100. Uh-huh. And then he left being undetected.
Well, that's horrible. But man, they had Church's Chickens in Seattle's back then. We don't even have a Church's Chicken in Seattle now.
You know, I think that I don't want to diminish what I just said by talking about Church's Chicken. I understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I were to be honest, I was like, oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. We grew up in Seattle. I've never seen one in my life.
Yeah, right.
But yes.
Okay. So yeah, not diminishing that. But this person
is a terrible dude, right?
Yes.
About 25 minutes later, I guess, because back then there was no traffic.
Uh-huh.
He drove to a Baskin and Robbins in Bothell, Washington,
uh-huh.
Which is actually another little place that I grew up
in. Uh-huh.
And while he was in Bothell, Washington, he robbed the two teenage clerks working the counter. So he just took the money and left.
He must figure Baskin Robbins are kind of easy.
He kind of has habits.
You know? Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So he did all of those things basically every day, every other day.
Right.
Committing a crime. And then he took the holidays off.
Okay. A little Christmas vacation.
Yes. So according to Ann Rule's book, The I-5 Killer, detectives compiled the following description. So this is a quote from the book. Tape on nose, green jacket or windbreaker type jacket, hood or ski cap, fake beard, gloves. No odors detected, soft spoken, rarely uses profanity, macho, considers his penis is large and brags about it.
When he's robbing people?
Yeah. When he leaves, he orders victims to count to 100 or 500.
Uh-huh.
The vehicle thought to be left several blocks away. So they never see the guy getting in or out of a car.
Okay, so they don't know what he's driving.
Right. He's a white male, 25 to 28, like around 6'1", medium build, dark hair, possibly curly, dark eyes, quote unquote sad eyes or tired eyes, good looking, possible acne scarring, weapons, a .32 caliber 6-shot revolver that's nickel or chrome plated, and then a bunch of other guns. I can't really pronounce them correctly.
Does he kind of look like me?
Yes, but taller.
Ah, why'd you have to bring that part up, man?
Well,
just let people think I'm 6'1". That'd be,
you're not.
I know, but that'd be cool if everyone's like, man, that guy, he's tall. He's probably just like a nice I-5 killer, you know?
I feel like you're asking me to say that so I can trick people.
I'm just saying, just allow them to imagine it. That's not
well,
tricking.
They can imagine it, you know? Imagination doesn't like necessarily include facts. Yeah. All
right. Right, exactly.
And then
point.
At the bottom of the description that they're compiling,
uh-huh.
They say vehicle, Volkswagen Bug. 3? Okay, so that's great. Like in the mix.
Okay.
Unbeknownst to investigators, there was a young ex-football player who was tearing up the 1980s Portland dating scene who very much fit that description.
All right. Okay.
29-year-old Randy Woodfield drove a champagne edition 1974 Volkswagen Bug with the front bashed in. He permed his hair into an afro,
uh-huh.
Cut a slick mustache, and wore a sexy lumberjack plaid shirt open all the way down to his belly button and tucked into designer jeans, exposing the thick mass of hair on his chest.
Nice.
His go-to was to find young women, preferably teenagers, in singles bars and talk in a low, soft voice about his quote-unquote sad childhood and tragic life.
Oh, no.
So, he was handsome and muscly and tragic.
Yeah.
But he had one pretty major flaw in his pickup game. He was way over the top clingy.
All right?
So, this would be an example of what we'd do. And This is so funny because, like, I'm not going to get too deep into this because I've got 8 hours of script to read through. But this reminds me so much of dating when I had a fake ID. Like the men that, because you and I have been dating since I was like 22, right? So yeah. I mean, it wasn't that long. But when I was like 20, like 19 and 20, I had a fake ID.
Yeah, we had a couple. We had a couple wild single years before you and I decided to.
And I think what's funny about it to me is like this is exactly what it's like to date when you are in a bar with a fake ID. These guys come out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. And it's something like, you know, you learn as you get older. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the time you're like, man, this guy, he's like 30. And he's so handsome. And he knows what to say. And then you just hang out for a second. You're like, oh my God, what is wrong with him?
He should get his car fixed.
You know, I mean, or just like it's the game of dating, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you're young and you're learning the game of dating. Yeah. And that's cute when you're talking to somebody else who's your own age who's learning the game of dating.
Right.
A little less cute when you're talking to somebody who's like kind of preying on you.
Totally.
Because you don't know very much and their game's not that great. Okay.
Okay.
So anyways, this is what he would kind of do. He would like walk up to a young woman at a bar, super cute, sexy, talk about his tragedies. Very, you know, huge hook for, you know, some
very,
ladies.
Very on brand.
Yes. He's buying the lady drinks, talking in a low voice, very gentle, no profanity. Okay, great. And then he would try to hold your hand within like 5 minutes in, right? And if that didn't work, he'd try going in for a kiss. He's like, I'm having a tragedy. The only thing I can think about is your eyes. Right.
So Muriel did act out reaching across the table and trying to grab someone's hand just for you guys. So, you know, so I know our girl is working hard today, but she's still going the extra mile to give the little details.
He would tell like all these women really quickly things like, I've never felt this way about anyone before. Mm-hmm. You're really special. I'm having these feelings like I could love you. Mm-hmm, he would talk about having kids like within the first 15 minutes, like just that kind of like that kind of thing, you know? He would also do a lot of this. He would also do this thing where he would basically beg women to take him home. So he would be like, come on, please, let me come to your house. Let me come to your house. Mm-hmm. I'll be a total gentleman. I just want to be by you for like 2 more minutes. I'll sleep on your couch. I'll sleep on your couch. Mm-hmm. So it's like the kind of thing he would do. So his tactics worked well enough for him to catch herpes. But his magic worked poorly on women his own age who seemed to see his bullshit from a mile away.
Yeah.
But he was totally objectively attractive.
Yeah.
In fact, in late 1979, Randy got really into sending nudes to ladies, like before phones.
Wow, the early dick pics.
Yeah, and then he even sent an oiled up nude to Playgirl magazine.
Uh-huh.
And the magazine wrote him back and was like, we are super interested in using you in our guy next door feature spread. And so he would like check the magazine every month to see if he had been featured.
Uh-huh.
But they kind of never talked him back, but he was like that hot, you know.
yeah.
All right. Sounds so who good. Is Randy?
He's an ex-football player.
So Randall Brent Woodfield was born the day after Christmas in 1950 in Salem, Oregon. After giving birth to two little girls, Nancy and Susan, this little boy, Randy, was the answer to Walter and Donna Jean Woodfield's middle-class 1950s prayers, right?
Mm-hmm.
The house is not going to be complete without your little boy.
Okay,
right?
All right, yeah.
Walter Woodfield, who went by Jack, skipped college and got a job for Pacific Northwest Bell Phone Company when he was 21, where he worked his way up in management to a comfortable middle-class lifestyle. And true to the times, Jack and Donna started their family real young, and they were in their mid-20s when Randy was born.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, Jack had a solid career with an income that could support a family of five.
And they owned a house.
They did.
In a state, which is a part of the United States. On the West Coast, too. I'm sure Salem's expensive now.
Oh, man. It's pretty wild, man. Yeah. I'm like, damn, you guys just did it.
Yeah, all right.
So, different world now. Okay. Uh-huh. So, Randy Woodfield was a gorgeous baby. Thick, black, curly hair, well-behaved and quiet. And he developed motor skills early. He mm-hmm. walked early, and to his parents' deep, deep pleasure, their masculine child was an athlete from a very young age.
I thought you were going to say had a huge dick.
All right, Nick. Your grandmother listens to this podcast.
Does she?
I think so.
Love you, Grandma.
So everything was picture perfect. Until Randy started flashing his boner at girls.
Oh, boom. See, I was sort of in the, you just, you know, you brought attention to it early. Now we're focused on it.
I
okay.
feel like you would have guessed that. Okay, whatever. Okay, so in middle school, Randy ran around the tiny town of Otter Rock, where his parents were raising their family, showing his wiener to a number of confused and horrified girls and women.
Yikes.
Who knew him?
Uh-huh.
Right? Randy was quickly caught because the town was tiny and everybody knew him. They're like, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's that Woodfield boy. Plus, his family was really like pillars of society.
Yeah, right. This was supposed to be the little kid like riding around a tricycle and being cute and charming and good at sports,
well,
or whatever.
Right. He's at this point in middle school,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it wasn't like, oh my God, what just happened? It was more like, oh, that Woodfield boy needs to put his wiener away. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Early on, police looked the other way. His parents were, like I said, pillars of the community, and he was a star athlete that even at a young age, most people in the town believed he would actually go pro.
In what sport?
Football.
Okay.
So regardless of the reason, he pretty much received no punishment mm-hmm. whatsoever. I think at one point he was put into counseling, but, you know, it was way more like of a boys will be boys thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Randy went to Newport High School, where he was extra sporty. He played football, basketball, and he ran track, and he was super handsome and big, 6'2", 170 pounds. He was great with the ladies, and he preferred his girlfriends to be young.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime when he was still a minor, but in high school, he did show his wiener to some young girls on the Gakina Bay Bridge, and he did get into trouble for that one, right?
And when you say young girls, you mean not high school girls?
I think like middle school girls. Uh-huh. So, right, he did get into trouble, but it was still thought of as boys will be boys mm-hmm. or some sort of fun time streaking. People hadn't really thought about, like, that type of sexual deviant behavior as something that would be an indicator of something else, right? It was more like, oh, man, that kid's pretty wild.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was convicted of, you know, indecent exposure, but he never served any time, and his record was expunged when he turned 18. All so right. that was just gone.
Mm-hmm.
According to reporting from Carrie Eggers for the Portland Tribune, one of Randy's former Newport High teammates said Randy was really narcissistic. Quote, Randy was a little strange. I don't know how to explain it. After all this came out, you look back, and maybe he was stranger than we thought at the time. He had an obsession with his hair. It was curly, and he'd go out of his way to straighten his hair. He was overboard. So
that's like saying he was extra. Or
yeah,
something
he was extra. Yeah. All right. Randy wanted to play pro football as a tight end and was scouted by all the top schools in the Northwestern states. He graduated class in 1969 and decided to enroll in the Treasure Valley Community College the following year in Ontario, Oregon. So that was another very small rural town, kind of like Otter Rock, that was on the border of Idaho.
That doesn't sound like a big football star.
He chose not to pursue any of those things.
Huh.
And I think he went to he kind of, from what I've read,
yeah,
might have assumed that if he's a big fish in a small pond, he might get scouted faster. That's what I'm assuming.
Yeah. I mean, I think being a big fish in a small pond makes sense maybe on a ego level for him. But if he wants to go pro, I mean, he would go to the UW or something. I mean,
well, we will have that conversation.
Okay, good.
Okay. At Treasure Valley, Randy had about a C+ GPA, like a 2.5, but he continued to be a sports beast. As a freshman, he played varsity basketball and was co-captain of the varsity football team and participated in weightlifting squads. He continued to run track and he held the freshman record for the long jump, which was 22 feet, 6.5 inches, which is like, damn, that's hell.
Yeah, that's so long.
So school was going okay and sports stuff was going great, but Woodfield was still being weirdo. He did things like steal small items from people in the dorms. Mm-hmm. He had an on-again, off-again girlfriend named Sharon McNeil, and after they broke up in August of 1970, Randy was actually arrested for breaking into her room at her parents' house and just totally trashing her room.
Ooh.
He went to trial for that.
Yeah.
But he was found not guilty due to lack of evidence. There was no specific evidence to say it was him, even though everybody knew it was him.
God, it's such a weird thing to do. It's so creepy.
Right?
Yeah.
Also, quote unquote, someone had been flashing his wiener around town again. So yeah. Randy decided to get out of Dodge and transfer to the Mount Hood Community College.
Uh-huh.
And this is actually, just as a little side note, this is when his extensive habit of letter writing really started. He kept in contact with Sharon McNeil afterwards, mm-hmm. even though he trashed her house, right?
Mm-hmm.
And tons of other female partners. He had a black book that had just phone numbers and addresses and all this kind of stuff. And anyone who didn't want to date him, he continually tried to pull them into his orbit, just his friends and acquaintances,
mm-hmm.
sending them letters and photos and stuff like that. So Randy corresponded with Sharon McNeil for over 10 years after he trashed her room. And
what did they talk about?
You know, just stuff.
And she was into it?
Yeah, like they would send each other Christmas cards, mm-hmm. mixed in with the occasional nude, just mm-hmm. like whatever, man.
just to remind everyone what's at stake here.
Yeah. So by 1971, Randy was floundering, right? He was 20 and, like you said, not even close to making it into the NFL.
Uh-huh.
He realized going to community college and being a big fish in a small pond had really backfired. And he should have gone to the UW, basically.
Yeah.
He found himself.
I mean, Oregon has great programs, too. There's like big colleges that the NFL definitely care about.
Yeah.
Over there. Anyways, yeah.
He found himself trudging through classes. He worked at a plywood mill in the summers and started dating teenagers as young as eighth grade. Great guy. By the end of 1971, something snapped.
Mm-hmm.
Randy decided to transfer to Portland State University and become a born-again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So Randy joined Christian clubs, only dated Christian girls, and was finally being scouted by the pros. Randy joined the Christian group, the Fellowship of the Portland State University Campus Crusade for Christ, and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, as well as a student-led basketball team called the God Squad, which I thought was great. And, you know,
yeah.
This whole time, though, he was still showing his wiener to unsuspecting folks. But this is like a bigger town.
Uh-huh,
so less people are like, that guy, I know you, right?
Mm-hmm.
In August 1972, he was caught again. Randy was charged and convicted of indecent exposure. But no one reported it to Portland State University. So his squeaky clean image was protected. So he had that on his record.
Yeah.
But nobody told the coaches or anything like that. In 1973, he was caught again in Portland showing his wiener and convicted that time of resisting arrest and indecent exposure. All, in the early 1970s, he was sentenced in total to almost 6 months in prison, never served a day in prison, and 1 year of probation. He was arrested for a third time in 1974 for public indecency and sentenced to 5 years probation and counseling, neither of which was enforced.
Mm-hmm.
He never checked in with his probation officer, and he never went to counseling. He had two more convictions after that and then had to do regular check-ins with his PO. So that's just once he's gotten caught for it.
So I lost track. That's about 25 times he's been caught.
Like, I mean, caught enough to be prosecuted.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
The rest of the time, I mean, that's not counting everything he's been doing since he was 12. Right. Portland State University's offensive coordinator, Mike Brundage, said later, quote, he was a pretty good athlete. He was very fast. He had good hands. He ran good routes. He was kind of a loner. He didn't have a lot of friends. It seems like he was by himself a lot. One summer, it might have been his junior year, he got into some trouble in a parking lot outside of Memorial Coliseum. He was exposing himself. I can't remember if we found out then or we found out later. You tried to work with him and tried to help him. He had some really good potential as a player, but he was having trouble between his ears.
Okay, great.
I mean, Randy was being scouted by the NFL. Mm-hmm. The PSU football coach, you know, was a little hesitant about him, right? He would go over his strengths as a player and be like, he can do all of these things.
Yeah.
But he had one deficiency that actually was consistent throughout his football career. Randy didn't like to get hit.
Mm-hmm.
Not by anyone. Like, if they had a scrimmage or whatever during practice, he's like the one guy who comes up with a clean jersey.
Uh-huh.
He just doesn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But in February 1974, Randy Woodfield dropped out of PSU, 3 semesters short of a degree in physical education, when he was drafted by the Green Bay Packers in the 17th round. So he was the 428th pick that year.
Right. That's still not bad, though, really. I mean, that's definitely great for someone whose college coach was like, yeah, he was pretty good. He had some potential.
Right. And like, I don't know that much about football, but there was a lot of stuff going on. There had been a strike earlier, and so there was like some drama. And then there's also a lot less teams back then.
Yeah,
there's
right.
more teams now. Yeah. So, you know.
I mean, it's a totally different league now, and the terms are so different, but that's still cool.
Right. The terms were so different that the Packers offered Randy a 1-year contract for a whopping $16,000.
Hell yeah.
With it had built-in performance-based bonuses.
Yeah.
But basically, that was really standard back then for new players. You got paid like any other job, like if you were working at a garage or something like that. So the Packers did have some perks, right? They sent Randy a first-class plane ticket to training camp where a limo would be waiting for him to take him to its destiny. But Randy declined, opting to drive instead on his own dime. He borrowed $300 from his parents for gas and hotels.
Uh-huh.
Now, this was possibly wiener related, right?
He's like, there's a lot of ground to cover. This is a lot of country I haven't been
right.
to.
Right. So he might have been like, I'm going off. I can show my boner to all people, and I'm going to have the best training season ever, right?
Yeah.
In July 1974, Randy and a bunch of Packers rookies got to scrimmage with the Chicago Bears. And that was this amazing experience. Randy survived all the first early cuts in training camp. He wrote back to his friends at home that he had finally found his place in the world. Mm-hmm. And then he was cut from the team basically 2/3 in.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
After he was cut, he did play a season with the Packers feeder team. He was still technically in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
So he played with the semi-pro Manitowoc Chiefs and then worked part-time for Oshkosh Truck.
Mm-hmm.
After that season, Woodfield was dropped by the Chiefs and Randy was formally cut from the NFL. So no reason was publicly given for the cut, but according to reporting from John Wertheim for Sports Illustrated, quote, there were murmurs, however, that the team had off-field concerns. While there are no public arrest records for Woodfield in Wisconsin, a detective would later learn that Woodfield was involved in at least 10 cases of indecent exposure across the state. As one Wisconsin law enforcement official recalls years later, Woodfield, quote, couldn't keep the thing in his pants, unquote.
Classic law enforcement quotes.
So 1974, after that season, he was formally cut from the NFL.
And that was it.
Right. And there's stuff that people say that indicate potentially that he knew he never tried again, you know, and he never tried to get back in.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It seemed like he was like, okay, yeah, they caught me, rather than...
Oh, I get what you're saying.
You know what I mean? Yeah, like, there wasn't any resistance to the cut.
Right. And he didn't train in the off season and try out for a different team
exactly.
the next time. Yeah.
Exactly. Randy was obviously devastated. The golden boy thing just did not work out. He returned to Oregon, but decided not to return to PSU to finish his degree. And at this point, he was 25 years old, the same age as his parents when they were fully established, married with three children and a promising career. And it sounds crazy now, but back then he was old as hell for not having a wife. You know, that's like, what's wrong with Randy, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So in 1975, Randy had returned to Portland in shame.
Uh-huh.
That is also the year when a series of women were robbed and forced to perform oral sex in a Portland park by knife point.
Oh, no.
To catch this predator, a policewoman named Annette Jolin volunteered to be bait, right? Uh-huh. So this was just happening constantly, and they couldn't catch him, and he wouldn't go after men.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually a pretty crazy sting operation because of the way things were set up. She couldn't see her backup, but there was a signal that she could give where they could hear when she's in trouble.
Yeah.
But they're pretty far away.
Yeah.
You're talking about knife point.
Yeah. Right. In a park. And they're just like, what, in bushes trying to be quiet?
Yeah. Basically.
Like 100 yards away.
Right.
It's horrifying.
Around noon. So he was doing these things in broad daylight.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I don't know why that's worse or not worse, but Jesus.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's pretty... very predatory.
Yeah.
Around noon on March 5th, 1975, a man stalked Annette Jolin through the Dunningway Park, held a knife to her throat, stole her money, grabbed her boobs, and then ran off.
Mm-hmm.
The money he stole was $8 in marked bills, and he was immediately arrested.
Good. Is the man Randy Tape Nose?
Yes.
Okay, good. I just want that guy to stop hurting people.
I love you. Okay. Randy Woodfield was charged with multiple sexual assaults and second-degree robbery. When ordered to speak with a state psychologist, Randy said simply that his life had fallen apart. He was absolutely flat broke. He had $57.50 to his name, and he had given every cent to retain his attorney. He owed $3,000 on a student loan. He owed his parents $300 for the gas he needed to drive to the Green Bay Packers thing and show people his wiener.
Yeah.
And
Green Bay Packers thing.
Randy told psychologists that, you know, I'm totally sober and a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed his compulsive violent sexual problems stemmed from his history of steroid use. But regardless of the reason, he told them he was no longer in control. He really wanted to focus on this idea that he needed money.
Uh-huh.
He was like, I'm broke and too embarrassed to ask my parents for money. So that's why I did what I did. But psychologists really saw through that. It felt like a very sexually motivated crime.
Yeah. I mean, he's robbing people for $8 and then forcing them to give him head.
Yeah.
Why? So that the rape is cover for the fat real crime, which is the money that he wants?
I think that's kind of the angle that he was going for.
Yeah.
They did give him an IQ test and he scored low, around 100.
Yeah.
And people were like, damn, he must have had a lot of trouble in school.
Yeah.
According to Ann Rule's book, The I-5 Killer, the final psychological evaluation read, quote, it would be my opinion that Mr. Woodfield's problem is so severe as to be a very serious threat to the community. And although treating him as an outpatient may actually present him with a greater opportunity to be treated, I think this would present too great a risk to the community.
Mm-hmm.
For the safety of the community, he needs to be in an institutional setting. However, chances of being successfully treated in such a setting are rather dim, unquote.
Hmm.
And the consensus was that despite what Woodfield says, right, the crimes were more sexually motivated than motivated by money.
Right.
And you kind of get what they're saying. It's basically,
yeah, I get it. Yeah.
If he goes to prison, he's not going to get better.
Yeah.
But if he's out,
they might be able to treat him, but he also is going to continue to do all this horrible
incredibly,
shit to people.
Right. He's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
In April 1975, to the shock of the presiding judge, Randy Woodfield pled guilty to second degree armed robbery in exchange for the prosecution dropping all of the sexual assault charges.
Oh my God.
So in order to avoid the trial, he just pled guilty to a lesser charge.
You said to the shock of the judge?
Yeah.
They let Randy's, it happen?
Yeah. At Randy's sentencing hearing, the presiding judge, quote, opined that Randy Woodfield should be placed in a program for sexually dangerous offenders in the Oregon State Hospital's psychiatric unit instead of state prison.
That seems reasonable.
Right. But he can't do anything about it. The prosecution just let him plead guilty to a lesser charge. So that's what he said in his, you know.
That's insane. He's out here raping women and they're like, yeah, let's just, okay, he stole like $70. Let's just get him for that.
Right. So the judge then sentenced Randall Woodfield to 10 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary. It's like the most he could charge him.
Uh-huh. Okay.
He was released on parole 4 years later in mm-hmm. July 1979 without any violent sexual assaults on his record. Randy was 29 years old.
Damn.
Now, while he was locked up, Randy kept in contact with his Christian buddies from PSU. And they would visit him and write letters. And Randy would respond writing letters in the form and style of the Apostle Paul, which everyone thought was just like way over the top. I guess they were just like, why are you writing?
What does that even mean? Form and style of the Apostle Paul. What's Paul's signature move?
You know, I actually don't. No, but uh-huh. They were using language terms like
thy and thine.
I don't know. Let's not go too far over our heads.
Just stay in our lane. Yeah, let's stay in okay, our we're lane. Showing wieners to people. Okay.
They know about wieners. Okay. When Randy was released from prison, that same Portland State University group uh-huh. threw him a party, like a reunion for everybody.
Did they just not know what he was really doing?
They thought it was the armed robbery.
Uh-huh. He was just able to keep that from them.
Well, I mean, who would know?
I don't know. Any friend maybe who would show up to like a court proceeding or just like read about it in the newspaper or anything. I don't know. It seems like you would know.
I mean, there wasn't a trial, you know. Mm-hmm. He pled guilty, so mm-hmm. there wasn't a big opportunity for it to be like publicized that he took a plea deal. Mm. Anyway, they threw in this big party. They're like, welcome back. And he showed up 2.5 hours late. And everybody was like super side-eyeing him. And after that, he lost contact with the group.
Really?
Yeah.
That was the straw that broke the camel's back?
He decided to head in a different wild-ass direction.
Okay.
Basically, Randy was trying to work as a bartender and have as much sex as humanly possible.
I can relate.
Right out of prison in the summer of 1979, Randy worked at the Cheerful Tortoise Lounge, where he was known for ignoring the ages on IDs uh-huh. and going after the youngest girls he could find, like 16 or 17-year-olds.
That is the least fun part of being a bartender. If anything, it's the older women. It's so fun. Older women at bars are the best when you're bartending.
I'm working on that. Okay. His coworkers at the Cheerful Tortoise Lounge uh-huh. later told Ann Rule that despite how handsome he was a total weirdo.
Yes.
That talking to him was, this is kind of mean, but basically they said talking to him was like talking to a teenager. And yeah. That he had this dumb blonde thing going on. Like he wasn't blonde, but
he reminds you of
that guy you worked with when you were making the iced tea and you were brewing the tea to chill it down. And he's like, what are you doing, bro?
Yeah, this guy was like, I was like, I'm making iced tea. He's like, yeah, iced tea. It's not supposed to be hot. And he was like a supermodel.
Right.
He's probably a famous actor by now.
Right, right, right. So that guy, yeah. That's kind of what we're looking at, right?
Yeah. And then I just didn't say anything to him. And then eventually I just put ice in the tea after it was done brewing. And then he came out to me and he was like, oh, okay, I get it now. That guy was awesome. All right. Forgot about him.
So the only woman mm-hmm. around this period to date Randy, who was not a teenager, later said Randy was kind of dumb and wore thin very quickly. And that mm-hmm. she was honestly embarrassed that she had dated him at all after she clocked his personality. Because he comes in strong and he's really cute and they're talking. And then it happens repeatedly where women will just be like, the next day,
yeah,
be like, oh my God, I cannot believe, I can't believe I kissed you. Like, this is so embarrassing. That's a big cringe factory. That's,
yeah, yeah. I mean, this guy is just a cringe factory, much like us, actually. I mean, for different reasons, but.
Yeah, better be for different reasons.
Vastly different reasons, but just also embarrassing.
Okay, shut up.
Okay.
In the spring of 1980,
yeah,
Randy was let go from the Cheerful Tortoise for undisclosed reasons. So we don't really know why.
Being a dumbass. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cheerful Tortoise also, that's the most ridiculous name for a lounge of all time.
In April of 1980, he was hired as a part-time manager for a bar down the street called The Faucet.
That sounds terrible.
But he was fired from there as well for not being able to control the staff or the drunks. So he was fired around October 1980. He was never charged with this, but later confessed to jacking the faucet for $3,000 after he was fired.
Nice. Good move. Good move.
They like found him in an attic and he was hiding.
Yeah.
And they're like, how could you do this? You stole $3,000. He was the only guy with the key.
Yeah.
And then he goes, how could you accuse me of this? And was like writing them threatening letters. And then later he told a teenager like, oh yeah, I totally jacked that $3,000. All right. In October, Randy got some bad news. On October 9th, 1980, Sherry Lynn Ayers, an old classmate of Randy's, was raped and murdered in her downtown Portland apartment.
Oh, no.
Sherry Lynn's family immediately suspected Randy Woodfield. Really? Sherry Lynn had known Randy since the second grade, and while he was in prison, they had actually reconnected and were writing letters. And then she had gone to that Portland State University reunion there where he was like late. Yeah. So they kind of reconnected there and they had been seeing each other occasionally since then. Randy seemed like a really likely suspect, but the semen found on Sherry's body didn't match Randy's blood type. So that's the way they were doing things before they were using DNA and forensics. It's more like blood type and hair type and stuff like
that. Yeah, they still had their training wheels on, kind of learning the ropes of
they were doing great work, but enough DNA.
I got you.
Around October 11th, 1980, Randy visited an old friend from Treasure Valley Community College, a man named Tim Rossi. So this is just a couple days after Sherry Lynn's death. And after Randy got super religious, he and Tim sort of drifted apart, but now they were reconnecting, and Tim had some heartbreak to share. His long-term girlfriend, Darcy Fix, had broken up with him and was dating another man. So he's heartbroken, but they're actually still friends and they still see each other. Meaning Darcy and Tim. On Thanksgiving Day, Darcy Fix and her boyfriend were found bound with tape in her Portland apartment and shot execution style in the back of the head.
Oh my God.
Whoever committed the murder didn't steal anything
yeah.
except for Darcy's old, unregistered, chrome-plated pistol that her dad had given her for protection. And the murders of Darcy Fix and her boyfriend Doug have never been solved.
Oh, so okay. But you said chrome-plated, which is the gun they described at the beginning of this whole thing.
Just be thinking about it.
Yeah, the I-5 killer did it.
Yeah, you're making connections. Your brain's like pa-pa. After he robbed the Faucet Tavern, Randy really couldn't get a job in any local bars, right? He was blacklisted.
Yeah.
He worked for minimum wage at a Shakey's Pizza and then a 7-Eleven, from which he was fired yet again.
Yeah.
Randy Woodfield was broke as hell, 30 years old, with zero prospects. But he had an ace up his sleeve. A friend from prison named Tony Neary was itching to do some robbing and taught Randy everything he knew
about robbing Baskin and Robbins.
The only thing he taught him was all you need to remain undetected was a piece of tape over your nose. He's like, you're not going to believe me, but if you put a piece of tape over your nose, no one will be able to pick you up out of a lineup.
Huh. What do you mean, just over it? Like, do you like make it a snout nose thing?
No, or over the top.
Like, just over the top, yeah. So you can't see if it's a long nose or what. Can't tell the shape of the nose.
He said that's all you need to know about robbing. Yeah. Randy, though, got a little freaky, and he decided to also glue a fake beard to his face for extra security.
Okay.
So they committed a few robberies together, with Neary using a .357 Magnum and Randy using a toy gun. The men used Neary's car because Randy's sparkling golden Beetle was way over the top. So mm-hmm. They didn't want to use that.
Overblown, if you will, or perhaps extra in today's parlance.
Toward the end of 1980, Randy decided to hook up with another old prison pal in Medford, Oregon for Christmas. Mm-hmm. So if we look at the whole scope of the year, he's been fired a bunch. He's done some robbing with tape on his nose with a buddy, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what he's been up to.
And probably killing those people. Come on, right? Probably killed those people.
So then he lands it up with his friend, and his friend is like, hey, come to Medford with me, and we'll spend Christmas together with my family. So Randy spent the holiday with Ralph Wansey's family and then went out trolling for chicks in Medford for his 30th birthday on December 26th. Mm-hmm. Ralph and Randy actually found a couple of women at a local bar, but unfortunately for Ralph and Randy, the sisters were definitely old enough and experienced enough to realize their embarrassing mistake the next day when their beer goggles wore off.
Yeah.
And Randy was quite obviously a pushy, desperate weirdo. The women saw red flags and they cut contact.
Uh-huh.
But a 21-year-old college student was waiting in the wings.
Oh, no.
And Shelly Johnson met and fell in love with Randy Woodfield at a bar on December 30th. So Shelly was actually super smart and reportedly very beautiful. She had a 4.0 GPA at the mm-hmm. University of New Mexico, so she was doing great for herself.
Yeah.
And friends and also Shelly admitted she had a very specific picture in her mind of the perfect man.
Uh-huh.
Tall, dark and handsome, knight on a white horse sort of guy, really chivalrous, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. soft spoken.
Yeah, we'll hold your hand.
Gentle, mm-hmm. someone who could fall madly in love with you at first sight.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Right? Perfect.
Not like us where we're like, we have to work on it.
Don't do that voice, man. People.
That night.
I can't even respond to that in an honest way to help the listeners grasp what even you're talking about right now. Okay.
I think they'll understand. Okay. So that night at O'Callaghan's bar in Eugene, Oregon, mm-hmm. Randy Woodford made his way across the crowded dance floor, chest bare and white man afro flowing. The pair talked heavy all night about like morals and mm-hmm. family mm-hmm. and love and destiny. And by the end of the night, Shelly went back to Randy's hotel room where he gallantly said it was too soon to have sex and just asked her for a blowjob instead. Randy met Shelly's parents. Randy met Shelly's parents, and then, you know, they all met each other. This is this guy. Uh-huh. Everybody's impressed. And then he drove off down the I-5 corridor to allegedly pay a visit to his sister while Shelly reluctantly went back to college.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now we're transitioning into 1981, after the first of the year, after this magical love experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In early January 1981, tall, dark, and handsome dude wearing tape on his nose and a fake beard robbed a gas station in Vancouver, Washington. This time, he was armed with an odd, antique-looking, silver-plated handgun.
Mm.
He made the clerk show him her boobs, took the money, and left. January 11th, in the same getup, he robbed the grocery cart market in Eugene, Oregon. The next night, in Southern Oregon, he robbed a cook named Susie at the Central Market. Now, Susie thought he was messing around. The gun just looked really weird, so he thought he was joking.
Uh-huh.
And he shot her in the shoulder. Ooh. But it was a clean shot. She survived. Uh-huh. She was okay. But it was a, she didn't even notice she was shot, actually. She just, she didn't even feel it.
Wait, you said she was a cook?
Yeah.
Damn, what a badass.
Yeah. January 14th in Corvallis, Oregon, Randy forced his way into a house where an 8-year-old and 10-year-old girl were waiting for their mother to get home from an errand. He molested both girls at gunpoint. And the girls ended up being incredible witnesses, mm-hmm. who memorized tons of details about the man's appearance, mm-hmm. with ultimately the 10-year-old confidently picking him up out of a lineup, wow. which helped seal the case.
Later. Yeah, yeah.
On a cold, wet Sunday night around 9:30 p.m., January 18th, on the outskirts of Salem, Oregon, sat an empty office building and shopping complex, a brand new construction called the Transamerica Building. Only a handful of people remained in the building, two of whom could be seen in the brightly lit large windows that framed the whole building. A red Ford Bronco with two women's purses inside idled in the quiet parking lot. Suddenly, the dark parking lot filled with police cars and paramedics, lights and sirens on full blast. Through the windows of the employee break room, first responders saw two nude women, one face down in a pool of blood on the carpet, and the other wandering around, bleeding from the head. Sherry Hull, the woman lying on the floor, had been shot 3 times, execution style, in the back of the head. She was in a coma. Sherry's best friend, Lisa Garcia, had been shot in the head twice, but neither bullet had actually penetrated her skull.
Oh, thank God.
So she was in shock.
Wow. And she's the one wandering around?
Yeah.
Whoa.
The two 20-year-old women worked as custodians for Sherry Hull's family company, and they cleaned the Transamerica building every Sunday.
Uh-huh.
Lisa Garcia said the girls were held by gunpoint by a white man in his mid-20s, 5'11" to 6 feet, slender build, dark brown hair, hooded black leather, waist-length jacket, and a Band-Aid on his nose. She said they were forced to strip, they were sexually assaulted, and then shot in the back of their heads. After being shot, Lisa Garcia pretended to be dead. She was just like, somehow I'm still alive, mm-hmm. so she just didn't move. Mm-hmm. And she waited until the shooter left to call 911. Sherry Hull.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then she had a lengthy conversation. She said, this is the address where we're at.
Whoa.
This is what happened. This is my name. This is my friend's name. There's my friend's Ford Bronco is in the parking yeah. lot. The motor's still going. This is how you find us. We're in the employee break room.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Unfortunately, Sherry Hull died an hour after reaching the hospital.
R.I.P.
She had just an insane yeah. amount of brain damage.
Yeah.
Lisa was coherent, but in critical condition. They found a bullet at the base of her skull under her hair that hadn't penetrated through.
Whoa.
And they were like, oh my God, I can't believe she got, you know, I can't yeah. believe that happened.
Yeah.
And then they were surprised to find the second bullet under her scalp, just above her ear. So they had just hit her skull and traveled under her scalp to different places in her head.
Weird. And then
it just happens some people have thick skulls.
Good for her.
I know. I was thinking about that, and I was like, I think my head is too small for it to be thick enough. that was my first thought. It's like, damn.
I'm sure my head is thick enough. I just don't think I would be as lucky. I just feel like she's blessed.
Yeah. The entire attack from beginning to end lasted only 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it was a very quick attack.
That's quick? It seems like it'd be forever.
Well, I don't know. I guess we're both. It's all relative, I guess. I've never been in that position. Maybe you're right. Probably right. I felt like it was quick.
Yeah.
Lisa Garcia made a full recovery.
Good.
But she contracted herpes from her attacker.
That fucking. I mean.
Remember who has herpes?
I remember who has herpes.
All right. On January 30th.
Everyone has herpes. Just for what it's worth. It's not a bad thing. It's a normal thing. Yeah.
You're right. But, you know, I did drop a little Easter egg there. Okay.
Right.
On January 30th, 1981, just 12 days after the Transamerica attack, Randy met up with love of his life, Shelly Jansen, in San Francisco for a lover's weekend. They called her, quote, love boat weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Shelly was a little weirded out that Randy only wanted to engage in oral sex, but she shrugged it off thinking, this is my knight in shining armor and he wants to save sex for marriage. Mm-hmm. That was her, her justification. By the end of the weekend, Randy Woodfield proposed. They had known each other for about a month, and Shelly Jansen accepted. Shelly Jansen, floating on air, left to return to school in New Mexico around New Year's, while Randy traveled up to Eugene, Oregon, and ended up renting a room from a single mom named Arden Bates.
Oh, no.
Arden Bates was around 29. She found Randy to be acceptable but odd. Mm-hmm. She had no idea how he made his money, and she was creeped out when he had sex with her 16-year-old babysitter.
Yeah, that'll do it.
He was a womanizer who made a ton of long-distance phone calls and did a lot of cocaine, but he was polite and a decent roommate.
Oh, he was doing coke this whole time? Or well, he just started?
When he was living with her, Arden Bates, she was like, yeah, he did a lot of cocaine.
Okay.
And she was like, how does he get the money?
Uh-huh.
He used to just eat only steak and do cocaine. You know, Stephen Sondheim had a heart attack because of that. So after Sherry Hull's death and Lisa Garcia's near-death experience, mm-hmm, at the Transamerica building, the Marion County Police Station fielded about 200 calls a day with tips from locals. People, mm-hmm, were just pouring in, right? There were only four detectives in the department, and two of them were working on something completely different. So, mm-hmm, it was very overwhelming. And unfortunately, none of the leads panned out. They also ran down a list of any recent parolees from the Oregon State Penitentiary involved in sex crimes or murder,
which Randy would not be on.
Right. And, mm-hmm, they found no matches with their description. Mm. Investigators initially tagged the killer as a drifter with no local connections who probably moved on and would never be caught. They just basically were like, not in like a negative way, like they were going to work on it, yeah, or whatever. Yeah. But the idea is that it was like a random killing, mm-hmm, which is actually a lot more rare than, mm-hmm, a killing by someone that somebody knows.
Right.
And they're a lot more difficult to solve, right?
Totally.
Because there's no connections to the person.
Right, right.
And he's on I-5, which, mm-hmm, is just like this crazy sprawling amount of real estate to,
mm-hmm,
cover.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Kominek was an investigator for Marion County, and he was in charge of the Transamerica case.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Van Dyke was the DA for Marion County in Oregon, and was also the son of actor Dick Van Dyke.
Very nice.
That's true.
Yeah.
On February 3rd, mm-hmm, Lisa Garcia agreed to let Dave Kominek hypnotize her in front of Dick Van Dyke's son and a sketch artist to see if she could come up with a more detailed description.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which I was like, did they just do that in the 80s?
Do they do that now?
I don't know, but they didn't say he was like a hypnotist.
Yeah, right. Like, I'm going to let you hypnotize me. Can you do that? I don't know. We're going to give it a try.
Right. So basically he came in, yeah, she sat down, and he did a lot of guided meditation.
Uh-huh.
And it had a lot to do with peaceful imagery. You're safe. You're safe. Uh-huh. You're safe. We're going to count down the days from now until the attack. Picture the calendar days.
Whoa.
You know.
Did it work?
Yeah, it totally worked.
Huh.
So after he gets Lisa Garcia to like the moment that the, uh-huh, attack happened, because she kept having a mind block.
Sure.
About it,
sure.
He left the room. So he sat with Van Dyke in the other room at a two-way mirror and then let the sketch artist just sit there.
Mm.
And the sketch artist would just ask questions and sketch.
Yeah.
The whole thing lasted for over an hour and a half.
Damn. Yeah. I think that sketch artist thing is such a cool skill. Like, I draw, and if you were like, okay, draw a square, I'd be like, I don't know if I could do that. That talent is amazing to me.
So with the sketch, Kominek released a bulletin to all the Northwestern states. And that same day, on February 3rd, 1981, the bodies of two more women were discovered just outside of Redding, California, in Shasta County, about 6 hours down I-5 from Salem.
Right, between San Francisco, where he just was. Right. That's horrible.
February 3rd, 1981, Donna Eckard, who was 37, and her 14-year-old daughter were found bound with tape and shot execution style in her home just outside of Redding. Both the girl and her mother had been sexually assaulted. The same day, a clerk in Redding was bound and raped in a holdup. February 4th, the next day, an identical crime happened to a female hotel worker working in Eureka, California. And a man matching Lisa Garcia's description robbed a hotel in Ashland that same night.
Damn.
February 9th, the same described man robbed a fabric store and sexually assaulted the clerk and a customer. And February 12th, a man matching the description robbed places in Vancouver, Washington, Bellevue, Washington, and Olympia, Washington.
Damn.
And that included three sexual assaults.
Man, well, Vancouver is hella far south in Washington, and Bellevue, Washington is basically as far north as Seattle. People, so he was really booking.
Yeah, and yeah. People say, like, he never slept. They never saw him sleep. He was just always coked up
and,
yeah.
And going hard.
And there was, at this time, this clash of MOs, right? The modus operandi or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Because the I-5 bandit, right, behaved very differently than the person binding and murdering pairs of women.
Right.
So you've kind of got this guy whose MO is to drive up and down the I-5 corridor, targeting women working alone in retail establishments, gas stations, things like that, right? And he's sexually assaulting and binding them. And except for the woman he shot in the shoulder, he has not killed anyone. And then you have this person who's going around and potentially taking tape and binding pairs of women and sexually assaulting them and then shooting them execution style, not to mention the three murders that were in Portland. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the couple that was shot on Thanksgiving Day and also Sherry Lynn.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff going on that feels like potentially it could not be connected.
Totally.
So now we come to Valentine's Day, 1981. And what do you think Randy Woodfield's favorite day in the world?
Definitely Valentine's Day.
His favorite day ever.
Yes.
He sent cards and flowers to all the girls he knew, attempting to set up several dates for February 14th.
Mm-hmm.
Most of his girls were very young and still in high school. And his plan was to try to set up a party at the Hotel Marriott in Portland that Saturday to kind of honor the holiday. Mm-hmm. He sent his fiance in New Mexico a dozen yellow roses. And he even sent his parents a really expensive arrangement out of carnations that they were going on a trip together, and they like packed it in damp paper and packed it along in their suitcase to take with them. Like, oh man,
yeah,
Randy's finally doing good, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's so heartbreaking.
In the early morning hours of February 15th, 18-year-old Julie Reitz was found sexually assaulted, nude, and murdered in her Beaverton, Oregon home.
Please tell me this is the last victim of this
just
story.
Just outside of Portland, Oregon. Just so right around there.
Is this going to be it, Muriel? This is...
Police had a feeling that she was with someone she knew because there were two wine glasses out and no forced entry, which kind of changes, again, the MO, right?
Yeah, yeah.
February 18th and 21st, 1981, this I-5 killer robbed places in Eugene, Oregon twice. On February 25th, he hit Corvallis, Oregon again, sexually assaulting his robbery victim. So we're going to go back to Julie Reitz. Mm-hmm. Julie was an outlier in many ways. First off, the I-5 bandit robbed and sexually assaulted, but didn't murder, like we're saying.
Uh-huh.
And then let's say the I-5 bandit murdered the six people so far who seem to be randomly chosen and killed execution style. Julie still doesn't fit that, right?
Yeah.
Based on the crime scene, she was the only person in this cluster of murders who seemed to know her murderer, right?
Uh-huh.
So investigators decided to to start questioning her friends. Forget the I-5 killer. We're just going to focus on Julie. They're probably not connected.
Uh-huh.
So they want to know, who would Julie let in after 2 a.m. on Valentine's Day? So they got a bunch of teenage girls down to the police station mm-hmm. and they asked a bunch of questions. So one of the answers was, no, wait, there was a guy, Randy. He was a lot older than Julie. He worked at the Fawcett Tavern. His name was Randy Woodfield. That was last summer. Julie went out with him maybe once or twice. He came on too strong and she told me she didn't want to date him again. But then she said they were going to be friends. He drove a gold Volkswagen Bug.
Mm-hmm.
Another girlfriend claimed Randy got them drunk once and talked them into letting him spend the night, where he kind of did some heavy petting, but they just like went to sleep.
Uh-huh.
Another friend of Julie said she specifically saw Randy on Valentine's Day in Beaverton, right near Julie's house.
Uh-huh.
One of the girls also mentioned that after getting fired from the Fawcett last fall, she heard Randy had moved to Eugene, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, Julie's roommate said, sure, he's been here, but Julie didn't like him. Would she have let him in if he came knocking on the door late at night? Probably. She didn't hate him. She just wasn't interested in having a relationship with him. He was older, quite a bit older, and he was pushy. But I think she might have let him in.
Mm-hmm.
So police look into Randy Woodfield. Still thinking, just yeah. Julie, just
right,
Julie.
Right.
And they call his parole officer. Now, the thing with his parole officer is that Randy has moved all over the state of Oregon.
What's he even on parole for at this point?
He's still
original
on, yeah.
robbing thing?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's only been a handful of years. It's 1981.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? He probably yeah. has like 5 years of parole or something. So the parole officer is a woman. Randy Woodfield does not respect her. He has a problem with women who work in law enforcement. He's just like very vocal about that.
I think he has a problem with women. Full stop.
Yes, he has a problem with women, full stop. He's very vocal about saying like women therapists and guards in the prison mm-hmm. are ridiculous. You know, he doesn't like them having authority over him.
Yeah.
So he never told her when he was moving. He was really hard to keep track of. And instead of reporting him, she's like, this guy is too much. Kind of like handed him to somebody else.
Yeah.
But they contacted his original parole officer, who was basically like, yeah, he's been really hard to keep tabs on. But, you know, guys, he did sexually assault a bunch of women at knife point before he went to prison. And I don't know if you know this, but he's been a suspect in 3 recent murders in Portland, too.
Jesus Christ.
Right, because he knew all of the people who died.
Yeah, yeah.
His parole officer basically said, quote, Darcy Fix and Doug Altick last Thanksgiving Day, and mm-hmm. Sherry Ayers a month before that. He was questioned, but never charged.
Mm-hmm.
Now, his blood type eliminated him as a suspect in the Sherry Ayers case, like we said before, but it did match semen samples taken from Julie Reed's case.
Mm-hmm.
So with all of this kind of new exchange of information, the old parole officer mm-hmm. and the newly assigned parole officer team up with investigators, and they decide to go to Eugene, Oregon to drop in on Randy at his rented room, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just ask him a few questions about Julie. Randy Woodfield said the following, according to Ann Rule. He didn't know anyone by the name of Julie Reitz. And then when shown his picture, he said, oh, you know, that Julie. I met her at the Fawcett and went out with her one time.
Mm-hmm.
They never had sex, and he didn't see her on Valentine's Day. When police asked him if they could go inside and like search his house, he said, quote, just because I had sex with her, I wouldn't have killed her. So they were like, okay.
Okay.
And then when asked if he would be willing to submit blood and hair samples and take a polygraph, he shouted at police saying that would violate his principles and he would rather go back to prison. Another odd reaction.
Okay.
You're going to go anyway. Right.
Right?
He's violating his parole. He's all kind of, you know. So Randy allows the police to search his home. And among other things, they found a bong, a bunch of gun paraphernalia and gun receipts, but no guns.
Mm-hmm.
And a box of 6 rolls of athletic tape. And the tape was the golden ticket.
Mm-hmm.
It was exactly the same type of tape the I-5 killer used to bind his victims and cover his nose.
So it was the tape, the one thing that guy tried to give him the key to success was the exact key that locked him up.
Yeah. They had come down solely to investigate Julie's murder.
Yeah.
But now there was this little hint, like that, you know, when the moth comes out at Clarice in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Right. There's this little hint that this might be way bigger than anyone thought.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, was Randy nervous about the tape. He's like, why are you taking that tape? That's yeah. my tape. Why do you need tape? Why are you taking all the rolls of tape? Right?
Yeah.
So now investigators have this tape confiscated. They've got some brewing things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decide to talk privately with Randy's landlady, Arden Bates. So it went pretty quick. Basically, you know, they say, hey, does this dude make a lot of long distance calls? She's like, yeah. And they're like, can I see the phone bill? She's like, I don't care. Sure. And then she hands him the phone bill, the police officer, and he starts going over it. And she's watching his face. And then she just straight up says, quote, it's him, isn't it? Randy's the I-5 killer, isn't he? I've been afraid of that, but I didn't want to say it out loud.
Oh, God.
She's been living with him for hella long. Based on his calling cards mm-hmm. and these phone records, police could trace Randy's phone records to almost all the murder scenes. They could basically trace mm-hmm. his pathway everywhere across up and down the I-5 corridor.
Even for the strangers? Even the people... Oh, just wait. I don't understand.
Like basically.
Not to the house of the victims, but just. Go ahead.
The phone cards.
Yeah.
Had records of the like where they were used.
Mm-hmm.
So if he decided like on the day that the two women were murdered in like Shasta, California, right outside mm-hmm. of Redding, he would have made a phone call from Shasta.
Oh.
Because what he loved to do is like correspond. He'd be calling women all the time.
Yeah.
Constantly.
They can place him in these different towns on these different days.
Right. Okay. Exactly at the times that he's supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. And then you can start to pinpoint him when he's on the road and he's calling, when he's like done some robbing, and then he calls when he checks into his hotel.
God, how much can a person's personality just tell on you every step of the way? It's just like, on one hand, it's so obviously him, and it's so like painfully, embarrassingly him,
yeah.
right? Because of all the things that make him painfully embarrassing.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he's not really sophisticated enough for it to logically make sense that it's him, you know, like with all the MO stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He's, I like that. That's an interesting take. Nick, I feel like you're really absorbing the story.
Yeah, I would say it's absorbed. Are you wrapping it up here? What's going on?
Yeah, we're almost there.
This is horrible.
Don't you ever. So after the phone records are revealed and the connection to Julie is revealed and now these connections to the murders in Portland, all of this stuff is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Evidence becomes pouring in from all of these police precincts all over Washington, Oregon, and California.
Mm-hmm.
And they all wanted a piece of Randall Woodfield. After some arm twisting and some like, I don't know, jurisdictional pissing contest mm-hmm. thing, I'm not going to go way into it. It's like 8 chapters, but basically everybody wanted to try him.
Yeah.
But the person to get the case was hypnotist Dave Komenek and Dick Van Dyke's DA son.
Nice.
They were the first to try their case against Randy for the mm-hmm. murder of Sherry Hull and the attempted murder of Lisa Garcia mm-hmm. at the Transamerican building. On March 4th, Woodfield's fiance, Shelley Jansen, quit college and drove all her stuff in a U-Haul to Oregon to start her life with Randy, where she was met with some pretty shitty news.
Oh, she really didn't know what was going on.
No, she really, really didn't.
Oh, poor baby.
Yeah, but she avoided a lot of terrible stuff.
Yeah, I would say probably the worst thing that could have ever happened to her, she avoided.
Yeah. On March 7th, 1981, Randy was taken into custody after being positively identified by several Oregon robbery victims. On March 16th, 1981, indictments from all over Washington and Oregon were filed against Randy for murder, rape, sodomy, attempted kidnapping, armed robbery, and illegal possessions of firearms. In the summer of 1981, he was charged and convicted of murdering Sherry Hull and attempting to murder Lisa Garcia, as well as for sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
June 26th, 1981, he was convicted after 3 hours of deliberation and sentenced to life in prison plus 90 years. In October 1981, he was charged with sodomy and weapons charges for an assault in a Benton County, Oregon bathroom, and 35 more years were added to his sentence.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't formally charged with anything else because there were so many cases and no death penalty in Oregon. So it was considered a waste of resources to sentence him to like a million bajillion years.
Yeah.
Before just like...
Well, did he confess and stuff?
No, never once.
He never confessed. So how did the victims' families feel?
You know, Ann Rule's book didn't actually really cover that.
Uh-huh.
I think that it was just a, you know... judicial decision.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Which did seem really unfair to me, but it really was so many. He did so many things.
So what's the total number?
So I think it depends on who you ask.
Uh-huh.
But by 1990, I think DNA forensic work was developed in 1986, I believe. Mm-hmm. So by 1990, he was linked to between like 18 and 44 unsolved murders. And DNA proved he was the killer in two more unsolved cases. He was also linked to somewhere around 60 unsolved rapes.
Jesus Christ. Well, I guess he was able to get some stats and something.
Nick.
It's
horrific.
Why?
So Randy Woodfield is currently incarcerated in the Oregon State Penitentiary mm-hmm. in Salem.
Yeah.
In April 1987, he sued Ann Rule for $12 million for libel because in her book, which we referenced today,
mm-hmm.
she said he had abnormally small hands, a low IQ, and herpes. That case was dismissed in 1988.
That's what he had beef with?
To this day,
yeah.
Randy denies his crimes and has been married 3 times and divorced 2x while in prison.
Wow, writing those letters, huh? Yeah.
He writes a lot of letters.
Wow, and I guess people really like that. People will love people love a good writer. Man.
It's like the last thing I'd guess you'd latch on
to. Well, I'm just saying.
Wow, letters? What?
You know? I guess people, that really works, man. Just put a couple words together on paper. Man. That's too many RIPs to mention. That's just a million RIPs.
Yeah, spree killer. He really just did. He did... a lot. I was researching this and I was like, yeah. Okay, cool. And I was like, whoa, so many, man. Just so many. It's crazy. I mean, it's just like hard to even put the picture together. You
I know.
If you tell it chronologically, it's just like.
It just gets boring. It's crazy because it's like such a crazy laundry list that,
right.
You know, you're like, you know, I forgot the names of some of the victims. Already.
Well, there were so many victims. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I tried to mix it up by like starting with certain things and then, like doing flashbacks, but I was just like, well, I was white knuckling it starting at noon. I was like, I gotta just do something.
You gotta get this on page, man.
It's drastic. It's a crazy story, and I've never heard of, I mean, I've heard of the I-5 killer, but I've actually never read this story. So thank you, Hallie, so much for your suggestion.
What do you think of naming a serial killer a nickname like that? Do you think calling him the I-5 killer gives him like a certain level of prestige or legend that, I don't know.
Well, I think that my gut reaction...
Mm-hmm.
anything that's snappy that lets me know where the guy is, I'm like, okay, now. You know, like the Brooklyn Stabber. I'm like, okay, I'm in Brooklyn. I'm not going to like get drunk and wander around, right? Okay. So that's where my mind goes.
Yeah. You're just like, yeah, I'd rather know, okay, where are you, not your first and last name.
Where are you and what are you doing?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Okay, right? Yeah. Put those two things together. All right. So with that, we've been the Los Angeles Podcasters. Thank you and good night. Thank you so much for listening to Muriel's Murders. Muriel did all the research and the writing. I did all the editing and post-production. And this podcast was recorded in our living room.
To help support the podcast and to unlock exclusive episodes, please sign up for our Patreon at www.patreon.com/Muriel's Murders.
We also draw and animate little bonus cartoon content on our social media feeds, so you can find at Muriel's Murders on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok. Our DMs are open and you can email us at murielsmurders@gmail.com.
Please listen, rate and review Muriel's Murders on Apple Podcasts. We all hate doing that, but do it anyway.
Yeah, it makes us feel good.
Makes us feel good. Yeah. It does like bump us up in the robot algorithm. It helps us grow. So if you're enjoying this,
yes,
you know, you don't even have to say anything, or you can do a little inside joke and we'll be like, ooh, ding ding.
Yeah. Okay, great. I guess you can also rate us on Spotify now. So if you're listening on Spotify and it gives you that option, give us some stars, baby. Our music is by Mario Castellini. Find him on Instagram at Castellini Beats.
Thank you to Ryan and Ryan at Campfire Media.
And if you want to hear us do a podcast about everything and nothing at all at the same time, check out our comedy podcast. It's called Hella in Your 30s.
All right, that's it, man.
Okay, I gotta go edit this. Bye.
Bye.